Hello there. Thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Amanda Vinicky. The 2024 match is set.
Presidential candidate Kamala Harris chooses her running mate in the race for the White House.
Governor Tim Walz of the great state of Minnesota.
Walz came out of the gate with an attack on his Republican opponents.
These guys are creepy and, yes, just weird as hell.
The selection means another VP contender will keep his current job.
It's an honor to be asked, even if some of those questions are like a colonoscopy.
And I don't know about you, but I'm ready to take him out for a shot of Malort. Because he's staying right here in Illinois.
With just over a week before the Democratic National Convention comes to Chicago, the city's police superintendent says officers are ready.
We've looked at past practices, we've looked at where mistakes were made, and we've corrected those mistakes.
Even if others question whether the city's really prepared.
We know for a fact that people are coming and people are mobilizing.
Intent on violence and diverting the media attention from a celebration of our democracy to a focus on their radical and anti-American agenda.
Meanwhile, a month after Sonia Massey's death, the Sangamon County Sheriff says he'll step down at the urging of Massey's family and the governor.
It's the sheriff's job to make people feel safe, and he's done the opposite of that by not answering questions.
An investigation finds the Cook County assessors ignoring home improvements when valuing properties, a misstep costing other taxpayers more than $400 million. And the White Sox give their manager the boot after losing 21 games in a row.
Now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Tina Spandelis from the Chicago Sun-Times, Alice Nitkin of the Illinois Answers Project, Corley J from The Tribe, and Mac Lederman of Block Club Chicago. Now let's get right to it. Tina, over to you. We know that Vice President Harris chose Governor Tim Walz from many others in consideration, including Illinois' own Governor J.B. Pritzker. Was he ever in serious consideration?
I was asked this question by these reporters before the show, and I would say
yes. What people want to know.
Yeah, he was part of the six, and I think being considered, six people being considered in the entire country is a big deal. I don't think he was ever in the top three, but they did take him seriously. He did fill out this 200-question questionnaire, lots of follow-up questions about finances. They asked for every statement he's ever put out. So they wanted messaging and everything that, you know, that's just to not get in trouble in the future. So he was taken seriously in that regard in the process. He was asked the same questions as everybody else.
So, Alex, why not Governor Pritzker?
Well, I think there were just better reasons to pick some of the other picks. It came down to Walz, Kelly Shapiro. I think obviously they were more from swing states. I think that some of the appeal with Pritzker was a lot of his fortune that he would be able to put behind it. But I think a lot of those resources and his, you know, think big pack are going to be helping Democrats across the country anyway.
Tina, anything to add there?
I think it's funny that he talked about the grueling process because it was like 10 days.
It is a really abbreviated vetting process.
Yeah, so I thought that was a little funny. I thought that was honest of him to say that it was a grueling 10-day process or so. But imagine being vetted for months and months like everyone else is usually.
The anticipation of it. Now, Corley, what do you think this means for Governor Pritzker's future?
I think that he is still considered a presidency in the future, but right now it allows him to stay in the state that he wants to stay in. He talked about staying in Illinois a lot. He's done so much for the state. So I think that it gave him a little bit more of a national presence when it comes to his bid for president in the future. So we'll see where that goes.
Boost that profile, but not being chosen, you don't think, didn't hurt his
chances?
No,
I don't think so at all. I think that it gives him more of a household name. People probably didn't know who he was. And I think that part of the reason he didn't get chosen is because he didn't kind of have that national presence like the other governors did.
And Tina, what about you as you focus on state government reporting? What can you tell us about Pritzker's future? He does seem to really have national ambitions. If not this year, is it in the future?
I do think it's in the future, but if Kamala Harris wins the presidency, she'll likely run for re-election. So you're setting up another timeline of, you know, 8 years or so. In Illinois, we do not have term limits for governors. He could just be a governor forever, make lots of decisions. I know that's part of why he didn't want to be vice president. He didn't want to be number two. He likes making decisions.
You want to be the person in charge. When you're in charge, it stinks to give up that power.
I think it would be really difficult for him. He was, you know, it's an honor to be even considered, is what he said, and it is, but he likes to be the decision maker.
And said he had not really contemplated the notion of being a member of a cabinet, something else that seems to be a potential, but we really don't know. Now, Mac, over to you. Mm-hmm. What about the momentum with this race and just Trump's adjustment to running against Vice President Kamala Harris versus President Joe Biden?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Governor Pritzker, I mean, I think Democrats are just excited to have a viable ticket to go up against Trump now. Going into that, for Pritzker, I think, you know, a great consolidation prize is the being the most powerful person in the whole state with the third largest city, and that's not a bad one for him. So Democrats have really united around the Harris-Walz ticket. I think Walz brings another great snap of energy to this campaign. I was just scrolling through my my Twitter, and I saw the clips of him kind of doing a media circuit, auditioning for the job in real time, and I think he captured the moment. I sent that to a couple people just because of how clearly he spoke. So for a Democratic Party that had such a difficult time with messaging, it just seems like Walz is potentially a breath of fresh air here.
He was the one, evidently, that came up with this weird insult to the Trump advance ticket. Alex, can you weigh in here on just the Trump team and how they're navigating these new campaign waters?
It seems like they're still trying to find their line of attack and their message. They're sort of, I don't know if you'd call it flailing a little bit. There was a news conference that Trump did the other day. What's interesting, and one thing that they are trying to call attention to, is the sort of lack of, so far, they haven't done an interview. Usually by this point, the nominee and their running mate would do an interview together. And we have been seeing these messages like weird and, you know, trying to get the vibes, but not as much in terms of what the, you know, policy agenda is going to be, or sort of, we're waiting for a little more detail there.
That's a fair, do you believe, fair criticism from Trump of the team? And why aren't they giving these interviews with reporters?
I think at this point they're just trying to keep a good thing going as long as they can. I think that momentum is going in their direction. They're getting all this great, you know, earned media attention from these rallies. And it's sort of like, why should we expose our candidate in any different way that is going to risk anything? But it seems like they're, you know, Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, talked to some reporters on the tarmac, gave a sort of casual Q&A, and said that she plans to sit down soon, and I look forward to seeing what a real interview would look like.
And she does talk to her reporters off the record all the time, and especially the people who have been following her for many years, so they are getting that access, and I think that's helping a little bit, where they're not getting as mad. It's unlike Biden, where there was all these counters of, where are these interviews? Because she's actually talking to those reporters who are on her plane or at the events. I think that's helping to smooth it over a little bit.
Boiling over the top as much, because we all
forever,
do know.
Though. That's not forever.
No, not forever. I mean, we all know, and thanks to each of you for being on a live program here with us, that you never know. You can slip up when you're on live TV.
And just to add, I mean, there's a massive elephant in the room here, too. I'm looking at Alex's beautiful tie over there. It's the Israel-Palestine issue. I don't think Harris, the ticket, has really clarified exactly what their position on this. For young voters, I know that this is beyond politics. This is a moral issue, stopping the war as quickly and soon as possible. Harris has been very vocal about wanting to put humanitarian aid into the Gaza region, into refugees, people who are there. But whether she will cleanly break from Biden's stance on Israel, I think, has yet to be seen.
Yeah, for sure. I have to definitely agree with that. She has a big opportunity when she comes to Chicago during the DNC to kind of highlight her platform, because we don't know that platform yet. She doesn't have one. You have people here, these organizers that have been protesting for a ceasefire in Gaza, black people talking about police reform and reparations. So she has a big opportunity when they come to the DNC in a couple weeks.
Reproductive rights organizations and trans advocacy groups also planning to protest. We are just about a week or so out from the Democratic National Convention. So to that end, Mac, back to you. What are you expecting by means of protests? We've had more back and forth, both in the courts and then from organizations, including the Anti-Defamation League, that say that they're expecting anti-American sentiment violence.
Mm. I mean, frankly, I can't tell you. I mean, I think this has been such a fast-moving situation with the changes in the ticket. We haven't seen a campaign this so short like this. I think potentially Harris can benefit just from the energy around that. I do think some frustrations from voters are being calmed, given that Biden is not involved anymore. Obviously, he had the genocide Joe line and questions about his age. But the issues of the day and of our country are still very much here. I don't know if people in Chicago have as much excitement to vote for a formal federal prosecutor who has a record of the criminal justice system that comes with versus how they turned out for a former school teacher, union picket advocate that was the mayor of Chicago. So I think frustrations from large swath of Democratic voters are still there.
Alex, the superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, member, the leading deputy for the Secret Service, was on WTJW, said, "We are ready." What is your assessment? Is the city prepared?
I have not personally inspected the Chicago Police Department, other than the we saw a lot of those clips that you just showed at the top of the show. Of frankly, a lot of it was very familiar and has not changed in recent, you know, decades since the 68 convention. Of the blue helmets, the batons might make people feel a little bit tense. But honestly, I think that one thing that we've heard a lot from the Chicago police is that they're very, very good at keeping order or keeping peace, I guess, in planned events. The NATO summit in 2012, you know, planned protests, they parade routes, they are able to prepare and plan everything really well and know exactly what's going to happen. It's the spontaneous kinds of outpourings of protests, you know, things like we saw in 2020 when the police were caught really flat-footed. So I think they seem very confident. We certainly see a lot of security out there with the giant perimeter that they put around the United Center. I know there are still some, you know, conflicts up in the air about the parade, I was about to say, the protest route. But I don't know. I mean, like Max said, we'll just have to see. But I think that they seem pretty confident, and they've certainly had a lot of time to prepare for this.
And training, Corley, over to you. You have reported that the city and the police department are going to be getting $75 million. That is not an insignificant amount of money in federal funding for convention security. What's that money being used for?
So the $75 million is for DNC security across the board. So 26.7 of that is going to personnel, with CPD getting 17.6. They're getting the biggest bulk of that money. And so it's to really kind of curtail the protests, keep everyone around the DNC safe. And it's really concerning because the mayor's office has hinted to a lot of it's going to permanent assets to the city, and we don't know what that means. I got a heavily redacted budget narrative from the Office of Budget and Management, and they kind of broke down this $75 million and where I got those numbers from. But what really is kind of where they're not being transparent is they're getting a lot of money for equipment and supplies, and we don't know what that means. And it's kind of very worrying when you think about what we're talking about, this police and how they kind of surveil Black communities in particular, and the dangers that they cause to these communities, and the investments they continuously get. The police department gets a big bulk of the Chicago budget already, about $2 billion. So to see them get more funds and to see that kind of have a permanent impact on communities is just really scary, and especially because they're not being transparent around it.
You don't know what that equipment is, and will it be used beyond the DNC?
Well, they have said that it's going to be a permanent security asset, but what that actually means, we don't know. In my reporting, I talk about how Milwaukee prepared for the 2020 DNC, which ended up being virtual because of the pandemic. They bought technology to monitor cell phones, and they kind of increase their camera network. So those are kind of things that we may be able to see how they use that money, but we're not sure because the CPD has not been transparent. And they also say it's because of security measures. They don't want to give too much away. That's something that the OBM has told me.
They are getting a helicopter, I think, is one thing that I've heard, which CPD has been asking about.
I'll just say it's really interesting what the city is doing locally under the auspices of "we are preparing for the DNC." I wrote about a homelessness encampment off the Dan Ryan Expressway that had been there for 4 decades in different various forms. It was kind of a left alone, hands off community. People would come around and support the people there, but the police rather would just drive by. That encampment was cleared out weeks ago ahead of what city officials said would be any interruption from the Secret Service if it ended up in the security footprint. I looked at the security footprint next to where the encampment was.
Is it in there?
It was nowhere near it.
Nowhere near it. And I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm so sorry.
No,
but
please.
You brought up the homeless factor, and we know that Ohio police killed a homeless black man in Milwaukee, and with the out-of-town police officers, 500 of them coming, and that's part of that budget breakdown. $79,000 is going to travel, but they did not say if that would go towards their pay for the out-of-town police officers. So that's kind of the worries of organizers and people in the community if these outside police officers will be out and around and policing them.
Chicago police leaders saying that they are going to leave CPD to monitor neighborhoods, and these anybody coming in from out of state or out of city will be monitoring more the DNC. But there's still a lot of questions and concerns there.
We did see that at RNC. Amanda and I are both at RNC, and we did see local or Midwestern officers all around in the perimeter, and then they were not outside. So I'm assuming it would be something similar to that effect.
You know, Tina, actually, in terms of it, let's move away from DNC preparations in terms of security. The governor did a little prep today by, I don't know, having a beer or two? Explain.
Yeah. The governor debuted two beers called J Beers, which are, it was a West
Not
Coast.
Not J Beers. J Beers.
J Beers. Like okay. JB capital ears.
He had a corn dog too, right?
That was at the State Fair, I think.
But these are Chicago craft brew, Chicago area. They were two suburban breweries, and they've made two different beers for the DNC. But it is for his events, so it's not really super accessible to the public, I don't believe. Centennial, it's a bar in River North, has a keg if you want to try it. I tried like a little bit of both because I was on duty, but it was good and easy.
And
but
he's also
he was
preparing
walking
a
around.
Speech.
Right. And the fun thing about that event was he was walking around with two beers, and I've never seen that before. Like, I never seen
like
him holding
beers?
An alcohol. No, like a plastic cup. Okay. But I made sure to note that in my story.
A double-fisting politician.
A double-fisting politician, yeah. I did ask him about his speech, if he's written it, if he's prepared, and he didn't say too much. I did ask him if he's excited to meet any, like, up-and-coming Democrats. It's kind of keeping it very general, but I think this is, like, the kickoff to him being the host, which he loves. He's like the party host guy.
So and advocated really hard for the Democratic National Convention to be here.
And for Chicago, and for people actually getting out of the perimeter to go to Chicago businesses.
Mm. Something that we will all be keeping our eye on, what it does for the local economy, businesses, restaurants, and, of course, those security concerns. Because they are front and center with Tuesday marking a month since Sonya Massey was killed in Springfield by a law enforcement officer who had responded to her call suspecting an intruder. And just this afternoon, that deputy's boss, Sangamon County Sheriff Jack Campbell, says that he is going to retire by month's end. Alex, what can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, we had just heard that from, this was, I think, the latest development that we heard today, that he had been facing a lot of public pressure, including from the governor, as we had just heard. Yet it's his responsibility to keep the community safe, that he'd been abdicating that responsibility. He said that he has been, he's decided to retire. As opposed to resign. It was an interesting choice of words. I don't, you know, Tina was just telling us about the language of the press release that was...
His statement announcing his
He was basically kind of making it about himself, where he said he felt that he was like kind of taking up too much attention and time within the community and being a distraction. And he did say he believed that he did the right thing, that the bad person's gone and that he's taking the hit for it. A lot of people do not agree with that. So it was kind of like a victim-y kind of statement.
So to that end, let's actually hear, because as noted, this came after mounting pressure from the Massey family as well as from the governor. Here's Pritzker's explanation.
He has failed to explain how he ended up hiring this deputy sheriff who has been fired from other departments. He failed to put forward reforms that clearly need to be made. Training and other reforms, and still has failed to meet with the Massey family. That seems to me, and I'm not saying that's a fireable offense to not meet with the, but that just seems outrageous to me.
No, Tina, back to you. The sheriff says that he had tried to meet with Massey's relatives, but they rebuffed his advances through an intermediary to do so. And he also says he followed state protocol for hiring. So does Illinois need to take action to fix some institutional failures here.
Sonia Massey's family definitely wants to see some changes. It seems pretty broad at this point, but some of the things include the fact that that officer was able to switch police departments so easily, just kind of understanding why people are doing that and taking a closer look at any sort of disciplinary actions, making sure that whatever it was that he was doing is documented. And there's also some provisions in the Safety Act, too, to try to prevent this type of thing from happening. So there could be...
But the Safety Act in place and...
It still happened. So they need to take a look at those loopholes.
It's an endemic issue that we've seen in the state of Illinois, this kind of hopscotching, a police officer gets fired for some kind of unprofessional or unconstitutional conduct in one place, and they can just get hired in another place. This is I want to shout out my colleague Casey Toner at Illinois Answers Project at the BGA, mm-hmm. has done a lot of reporting on this. Particularly the village of Robbins has just, in the south suburbs, has become like a magnet for police officers who are fired from other jurisdictions, and this is a byproduct of the fact that there's no state licensing of police. This is all done by municipality. A lot of them are really, trying to hire anywhere that they can or facing staffing crises. The Massey family, we've heard, has been trying to appeal to state legislators. We need to close loopholes. We need to fix this. And so far, correct me if I'm wrong, from state legislators, there's not that much appetite to certainly, reopen the Safety Act and get back into the law.
It does not seem as if there's any advancement there. Now, Alex, I want to stick to you because we've got about 4 minutes left, and you, along with the Chicago Tribune, were part of a deep dive that looked into the Cook County Assessor's Office and found that hundreds of properties were misclassified. How?
That's a question that we've been asking over the course of the past 9 months that we've been working on this investigation, and frankly, we never really got an adequate answer to why exactly. But this is something that you never really think about, but is a really critical aspect of making sure that all of our homes and businesses and properties are taxed fairly, which is that the assessor knows what the building is. And basically what we found is that through a lot of different oversights, both in different parts of the county government, through municipalities and what they're supposed to send to the assessor's office, but ultimately the assessor has just missed lots and lots and lots of new construction over the last 5 years at least, and this has been an endemic problem going back before Fritz Kagi was elected, but it certainly has not gotten better since he's been there. If anything, we've seen that the problem has continued to spiral, and we found that the consequence was, just from this sort of partial audit that we were able to do, we found 620 properties that are being taxed as if nothing had been built there. So we found lots and lots of really big, new, lavish homes that are being taxed as though they're worth $50,000 and though they're vacant lots.
When they're worth something probably like $1 million or who knows what they're worth. And that means, of course, that other taxpayers are left really carrying the bag. They're going to be paying more.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's one of the problems here, is that when anyone is underassessed unfairly, it means that everyone else is unfairly going to have to pay a little bit more. The other problem is that those folks who, when they're underassessed and the assessor realizes the mistake, they can not only get a really sharp, abrupt jump in their taxes, but they can be back taxed. And so we talked to a lot of folks who had been living in a home, didn't realize that they had been paying taxes as if they were on a vacant lot, and then suddenly they're landed with a property tax bill with 3 years' worth of property taxes.
The whole budget
they had to pay all at once.
Out of loop.
That's right.
Let's switch gears now to talk transportation. So, Mac, after years of delays, years, I think seven, a new Green Line station opened at Damon and Lake. Why was this project so delayed?
That's a great question, Tina. They blame the pandemic. They blame red tape with supply chain issues, trouble finding a contractor. I think you can ask people different things, and they'll have a different answer for you about why this was delayed. But I think everyone kind of knew the deadline that was approaching for this stop, and that was the Democratic National Convention.
How come?
It's built right around the corner from the United Center. So after years and years of struggling to get this project across the finish line, it had two separate groundbreakings. It was first promised to be completed in 2020. Several weeks before the conventions, now it's suddenly finished. So I think a lot of this has to do with shepherding delegates around to the convention, impressing people, and showing a good version of Chicago for everyone to see.
And Corley, we've got about a minute left. This new station, how is it going to impact residents, particularly on the south and west sides?
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely have a long-term impact, and I think that that's a positive about it. But it should have been done, like Mac alluded to. They promised this so long ago, and to see it happen around the DNC is kind of like heartbreaking, but I'm glad that they have it, and it will lead to a long-term impact for them to get better access to their jobs and wherever they need to be.
And that comes, I believe, is actually WBEZ and the Sun-Times also reporting about a long delay in getting elevators and accessibility to CTA stations. Going to be about a decade for that to happen. So longer than 7 years. We are out of time. So our thanks to Alex Nitkin, Tina Smandelis, Corley J, and Mac Lederman. We will be back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family. The Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
So, Mac, the White Sox finally snapped a 21-game losing streak, but then they fired their manager. Why now?
I mean, why not way before, I think, is the better question here. Literally, they were asking to fire the manager of the team since he was hired exactly 2 years ago. So the team is utterly directionless, and I don't really know where they're going to go from here.
And I'm Amanda Vinicky. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a great night. That is our show. Appreciate everybody going. So speaking of, let's stick with sports.
Yeah.
The Olympics. How's Illinois done?
Good, I think. Good
we
swimmers.
We had some good athletes.
Yeah, I think we have some great swimmers.
Ryan Held, yeah. I'm a big fan, Springfield swimmer.
Oh, you have a long jump person or whatever?
Deanna, French, I believe is her last name. I might be butchering that, but a graduate of SIU who did not medal, but was close.
From your little local Chicago and finished second in the silver.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its founder and senior partner, Robert Clifford, who ranked number one in the state of Illinois by Super Lawyers Top 10 2024 Illinois Super Lawyers List.